I'm Dick Gordon. This is The Connection. When someone wants to be president of the United States, they have to explain why. They have to say what's wrong with the current president, and they have to say what they would do that's different. If only it was that easy. As the 9 Democratic hopefuls vie for the attention of the party, the media, and potential voters, they also have to attack each other and make sure that no one candidate builds an insurmountable lead. And that brings us to the current attention being lavished on Howard Dean. He appeared to put his foot in it last week in a call for a more even-handed approach in dealing with Israel and the Palestinians. Here's how Dean tangled with Joe Lieberman on the issue in a broadcast debate last week.
We need to be a credible negotiator, a facilitator for peace in the Middle East, and that means we have to be trusted by both sides.
All of us here on the stage have quite correctly criticized George W. Bush for not standing by our values in our foreign policy. That is exactly what Howard Dean's comments have done.
I'm disappointed in Joe. My position on Israel is exactly the same as Bill Clinton's. I want to be
not
an honest...
Right.
Excuse me, Joe. I didn't interrupt you. We need peace. It doesn't help, Joe, to demagogue this issue. We're all Democrats. We need to beat George Bush so we can have peace in the Middle East.
Dean's rivals and critics wagged their fingers, saying it's proof that Dean has no foreign policy experience, that sensitive issues like this can't be messed up with mixed messages. Connection listeners, you're the ones who'll make the final choice as voters, so tell us what you think. How is this supposed to work? Should the Democrats be debating all aspects of foreign policy, or is there a risk that saying too much on such sensitive issues is bad for the party or bad for the country as a whole? Our number is 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. And with me today, Joe Klein, senior writer at Time Magazine. He's joining us from a studio in New York. And Mark Ginsburg's also with us on the program. He was ambassador to Morocco during the Clinton administration. He's the author of a new article on how Democrats can compete on foreign policy in the latest edition of the Weekly Standard. Welcome to both of you.
Hi, good
morning.
To be here.
Joe, I noticed that you've been writing a lot about the Democrats lately. You were obviously watching that debate. Tell me what was going through your mind when you watched that particular tangle.
Well, there were two thoughts, and they were competing thoughts. Number one was that this tangle exposed Howard Dean's lack of experience in foreign policy, because those of us who have covered this issue over the last 25, 30 years know that the term even-handed is code for tilting against Israel. It's the term that the Arabists in the State Department often used, and Dean clearly wasn't aware of that. He later said that he wasn't aware of that. On the other hand, Dean was being attacked for the commission of a truth, and he said several things during the course of the week. One was that if the Israelis want peace, they're going to have to shut down an awful lot of those West Bank settlements. Another was, that there were going to have to be concessions on both sides, and that the United States was going to have to be a little bit tougher with Israel. At least that was the implication. That's true, but it's something that is unacceptable to say in politics these days because of one major factor, or maybe four major factors. The four counties on the southeast coast of the state of Florida that helped to decide the last election.
I want to go back to explore that in a little more detail, but Mark, maybe you can just jump in on this. When you hear that kind of tangle taking place at the debate, do you sit there in some sense of satisfaction? This is the Democratic Party arguing the essence of leadership and precisely what we ought to be doing, or was your head in your hands going, oh, my God?
Angle on this, having worked on several presidential campaigns, particularly with the Jewish vote going all the way back to President Carter, the Jewish vote in the Democratic Party is an important asset for the Democrats, and it has slowly been drifting, particularly since 9/11, over to the Republicans, to the point where there was a sense among the Karl Rove and other Republican operatives that the Jewish vote, which was never up for grabs, is increasingly up for grabs. And for Howard Dean to make a statement that, particularly when Israel is perceived among Jewish Democrats and much less Jewish Americans under attack, it creates the perception that he it doesn't have a foundation on which to at least get a strong handle on what is bothering the Jewish Democratic vote at this point. So that was where I was most concerned about. But frankly, I know and have spent time with the governor, and I agree with Joe, his callowness in this area is going to be corrected. But it serves to remind us once again as Democrats that we need to have a more muscular foreign policy if we're going to compete more effectively with the Republicans.
But Joe, does that mean that there needs to be one specific message to those Democratic Jewish voters and then another larger message that might be different to the rest of the country or people abroad?
Well, I'm afraid, let me just speak about muscularity. I think intelligent muscularity would be a very good thing for the Democratic Party to be selling this year. But muscle-bound stupidity and reflexive muscularity isn't so good. The problem here is that you're dealing with a very tiny constituency. Karl Rove, I'm sure, is thinking, if I can move 5% of those Jewish voters in those counties in Florida, we'll win Florida this time, and we'll be in a lot better shape. Now, unfortunately, the Jewish vote, like the black vote, has been monolithic. And I think that on these issues, it's also been monolithic. Any criticism of Israel for the vast majority of Jewish Americans, and certainly for the leadership of groups like AIPAC and the other Israeli lobbying groups, any criticism of Israel is intolerable. Now, that's bad for America. I'd say it's probably bad for Israel, but I think that it's probably bad for a Democratic candidate to raise it because the electoral implications are just so enormous.
Mark, your piece in the Weekly Standard is called Avoiding McGovernism, How the Democrats Can Compete on Foreign Policy. Did you come up with a rule or some way of raising questions about an incumbent or an administration without getting into the kind of trouble that Dean appeared to get himself in last week?
Absolutely. I think that given, look, all Americans want to win the war on terror. All Americans understand the implications of appearing weak abroad. All of us Democrats, and I chair the largest Democratic foreign policy organization in the country as well, called the Alliance for American Leadership, which has brought together almost all of the major Democratic foreign policy activists in the country. The reason why I wrote this article is because looking at the polling data in Joe's competing magazine Newsweek back in August, there were about 61% of those registered Democrats who were polled indicated they want to pull our troops out of Iraq.
Is that McGovernism? Is that what you mean by avoiding McGovernism?
Exactly. And those Democrats who have been running away from their votes in the Congress authorizing the use of force and in effect trying to suggest that their favor of rapidly internationalizing the conflict is a way of almost pushing the Iraq equation out of our hair, I think miss the most fundamental point in what we face as Democrats going forward, and that is there's a perception among the electorate at large that Democrats do not have the staying power, the determination that Republicans apparently have to persevere in the war on terror. And I think that the polling data that we consistently see on this raises serious questions of why the Democrats permitted themselves to get into that box in the first place. And secondly, certainly appealing to those leftist elements in the party who want to just lock, stock, and barrel pull out of Baghdad and hightail it home, only appeal to the worst instincts in the party and also play right into the hands of those voters as well as the White House spin machine that would like to continue to portray the Democrats as weak on national security.
So Joe, what's the history here that we need to know when we look at McGovernism or Eugene McCarthy?
Let me say a couple of things about polling, first of all. When only 10% and usually less than that of the people who are polled actually answer the phones, there are major questions about accuracy of polling. And also when the Democrats say, as the Democratic Leadership Council, as Evan Bayh, the head of the Democratic Leadership Council, said, we have to support this war because the polls say that the American people think that we're not strong on defense, which is what was just said here. I think that that's an example of muscle-bound rather than muscular foreign policy. in this case, I agree that that those Democrats, Dennis Kucinich is a good example, and Dean seemed to be, you know, tiptoeing around this, who are in favor of pulling out of Baghdad at this point, are, you know, profoundly wrong on the merits, but they may be right on the politics. I mean, you know, that same poll that was cited and others, you know, show a broad sense that people want to spend less, not more, on this war, and they want to pull the troops out of there. I think that this is the most serious foreign policy crisis that we've faced since Vietnam.
But this is where I need one of you to help me out just a little bit here, because we talk about McGovernism as if it's a bad thing. In 1972, that's what he was saying, at a time when a lot of Americans wanted the troops out of Vietnam. So what was wrong with it then, and why is that lesson relevant
today?
It's
not so much McGovernism. I think the McGovern's position on the war, you know, has been historically proven to be right. But there was a kind of weenie-like quality to that campaign, and a certain ineptness and an anti-Americanism that was very much a part of it. Mm-hmm. The Democrats have reinforced that impression over the last 20 years, especially, you know, on their votes on the first Gulf War and their opposition to almost anything that the United States wanted to do overseas. Now, in this particular case, this second Gulf War, a very plausible case could be made, and a muscular case could be made, that this war was wrong. Bob Graham, who's running for president, happened to make that case, and day by day it's becoming more and more clear that Bob Graham and the others who opposed this war were right, including Howard Dean. However, now that we're there, I agree, it is totally irresponsible to lead the American people to think that we can get out easily or quickly.
Mark Ginsburg, muscular or muscle-bound? It's a fine distinction here.
We're talking California politics then, right? I don't like this distinction between I'm not sure why Joe wants to keep using that. I think it comes down to a most elementary issue. There's a broader war on terror that we have to deal with. We tend to have now focused almost like a laser beam on the situation in Iraq, and yet the situation in Afghanistan is increasingly unmanageable and far more dangerous than most Americans realize. Whether the justification, I don't want to fight the justification for the war all over again. We are where we are. And there are very good reasons why Joe is right, that and Democrats such as Dean and Graham and others have raised serious questions about it. And the fact is that the war has now created a situation where it has become open season for every radical Islam who couldn't get to Afghanistan is now trying to make it into Iraq to wage war against the United States. Thank you very much, courtesy of a White House coddled Syria and a Iran government that wants to make as much havoc for us as possible. But let me just finish with one specific point. The Democrats here clearly have an opportunity to get the peace right where the Republicans in this White House are getting it wrong.
Connection listeners, our number is 1-800-423-8255. Just how critical can the Democratic candidates be at this point on all issues of foreign policy? Are there limits that they need to pay attention to? 1-800-423-TALK. I'm Dick Gordon. This is The Connection from NPR. I'm Dick Gordon. You're listening to The Connection from National Public Radio. This hour, a conversation about just how far the Democrats can and should go in their conversations about foreign affairs, particularly at such sensitive moments in Israel, in dealings there with the Palestinians. Word today that perhaps Yasser Arafat might be targeted like one of the Hamas leaders, and whether or not the Democrats can just leap into that pool without any consequences. Also, all the talk about Afghanistan and Iraq. Two people to help us with it on the program today. Joe Klein, a senior writer for Time magazine. The last time he was here on The Connection, we were talking about his book, The Natural, Bill Clinton's Misunderstood Presidency. He's also the author of Primary Colors, The Running Mate, and a number of others. Ambassador Mark Ginsburg is joining us from a studio in Washington, D.C. He was ambassador to Morocco under Clinton from 1994 to 1998, and He's currently working in the private sector, chief executive officer and managing director of North Star Equity Group, but has his hands well on in Democratic politics as well. Joe, let me go back, if I can, to your very first answer, because you said there's one part and another part. And one I wanted to pick up on is you said that Dean's use of the notion or the idea of being even-handed in Israel is a code word that everyone inside the Beltway knows means being, you know, tilting away from Israel and toward the Palestinians. What Dean is saying in response to that is, you know what? I'm not a Washington insider. I don't know the code language, and that's a good thing. And I'm wondering whether or not he, you know, you've seen this often enough. Is that a tactic of retreat, or is that something that he can turn to his advantage?
Well, I'm sure that he could probably turn it to his advantage, but I think that we've seen with this current administration just how dangerous it is to have a president who isn't familiar with the nuances of foreign policy. I think that, you know, to return to the other question, Democrats can go as far as they want in criticizing George W. Bush and this administration as long as they remain responsible. I mean, things have really changed in this country. We went through 20, 30 years where, you know, affluence was the most important factor in American life. There weren't major decisions that had to be made in Washington. And right now, we are in deep trouble. And so the politicians have to change the way they play the game, and they have to pay enormous attention and give a great deal of respect to the facts on the ground in places like Israel and Iraq. And what you're not seeing from some of the Democrats is that sort of attention and respect. But I have to say that leading up to the war in Iraq, and also with regard to Israel, President Bush didn't pay attention or respect to the facts on the ground either. He fell prey to an ideology, which is being widely called neoconservative right now, but it's a kind of utopian conservatism, which held that we could go into Iraq, we would be greeted with rose petals, we would be able to quickly and easily establish a democracy there, and that would start dominoes falling throughout the Middle East, which would make life a lot easier for the Israelis as well. Joe Lieberman, who, by the way, has been entirely responsible on the post-war stage in Iraq, was completely irresponsible on the pre-war stage. He told me that he believed in that domino theory. And so what we have here, if you're still following me, is a completely complicated situation, and it needs, rather than broad sweeping statements and theories, it needs careful attention to the detail work of foreign policy, which we haven't gotten from this administration, and which I fear in some of the cases with the Democrats we're not getting either.
But, Mark, it still seems that there is a certain distance that the candidates could go in criticizing Bush on Iraq before their criticism gets marked unseemly. They could probably go a little bit farther in Afghanistan. Whether that's because of the constituency here in America or not, I'm not sure. But they're much more limited in what they can say in terms of raising questions about America's policy as regards Israel and the Palestinians. Who sets those rules? And how are the candidates supposed to know what's too far and what's not?
The candidates are feeling their way, but you know, I spent 30 years in the Middle East. I was raised there, and I have to take exception to what Joe said, that somehow it's a utopian view that there's a dominoes effort that it's at work. The fact remains is that the status quo in the Middle East, clearly among Democrats, is unacceptable. And the war on
when you say
terror,
the Middle East, do you mean Iraq, Israel, or are you talking specifically about?
I'm saying that the status quo that we have inherited in the Middle East is unacceptable for American security in the long
Mark,
run.
Mark, do you mean the Israel-Palestine or the whole region?
I'm talking about the whole region. The whole region is a cauldron of anti-Americanism, largely fed by a variety of sources. And changing the status quo by helping to build better civil societies, the greatest fear that the surrounding countries of Iraq have is that we will succeed. Iran is fearful that we will succeed. Syria is desperate that we shall fail. They want us to fail. Saudi Arabia wants us to fail. They all want to see us fail in Iraq because they're fearful of what a decent civil society in Iraq may bring and may cause stirs in their own countries. And Democrats understand that, as we have always understood, that the best foot forward that we can put as Americans is not merely our military boots on the ground, but planting the ideas of change. We are going to have to confront radical Islam, not by guns alone, but by winning the battle of ideas. And the only way we're going to defeat radical Islam in the Middle East is by winning and waging an effective battle of ideas, which Democrats, far more than Republicans, are better than doing. It was almost a travesty that a few months ago, on the run-up to the Iraq War, Secretary Powell unveiled a paltry $29 million Middle East Partnership Fund, when we really need to have a major Marshall Fund for the Middle East. And the Democrats are far more capable of pointing out to the American people that, as the Republicans barely are able to convince themselves that they need more troops on the ground to destabilize Iraq, they have no more of an effective policy for dealing with the consequences of Islamic radicalism as it confronts the United States and other countries in the years to come.
All right. I want to open it up a little bit and hear from some of our callers. Our number is 1-800-423-8255. First to Northborough, Massachusetts, and Bill's on the line. Hi, Bill.
Good morning.
Thanks for calling.
Thank you. I've been listening to some of this intellectual slop speak, and let me make
What's slop speak about it, Bill? Come on.
Well, okay, let's get straight to the point. Howard Dean got it exactly correct. Your guests and the other Democratic candidates did not. It's about time somebody told it exactly what it is. I don't really care what Mr. Dean said that's supposed to be diplomatic code for slanting away from Israel or whatever. He was right. American policy needs an even-handed approach to the Middle East, and everyone in the world, our European allies as well as the rest of the world, know that the American approach to the Middle East is not even-handed.
Joe Klein.
Well, I think that's the kind of argument we're going to get from Dean people and a lot of other people in this country, and arguably it's true. I mean, as I said, Dean got caught in the commission of a truth. The Israelis are going to have to make significant concessions.
Thank you.
If I said that right up at the top, the policy of this current administration has been a Likud policy. And I really believe, as someone who has been going there, you know, for 25 years and also, you know, believes that there should be a state of Israel, there will not be a state of Israel if the current policy continues. If they evict Yasser Arafat, if they kill Yasser Arafat, it will only make it worse. And the Bush administration policy about the Middle East for the last year has been as much of a fantasy as its policy toward Iraq. The fact is that Yasser Arafat is the leader of the Palestinian people. He's a son of a gun. Well, that's a euphemism.
No, but that's a radio euphemism. You can go ahead.
It's a radio euphemism. He's a terrorist. He's a terrible guy. He has chickened out on peace a number of times, but he is the leader of the Palestinian people. And what we got as a result of trying to ban him from the process a year ago was a much worse situation. You know, the so-called roadmap, another fantasy. And it's a wonderful fantasy. I'd like to see it enacted, but you're not going to have it enacted unless you have the leadership of the Palestinian community involved in it. And the notion, the Israeli notion, and also the American notion that you could do it without Arafat, as terrible a human being as he is ridiculous. And let me just say something to what Mark said before. If we're going to win if we're fighting a battle of ideas in the Middle East, we're not going to win it by unilaterally invading Iraq. I mean, that is exactly the opposite way we should be going. I bring you back to Bob Graham. There is a camp, you know, the first order of business was Al-Qaeda. And Al-Qaeda's greatest defender and fundraiser and funder in the Middle East is Saudi Arabia. And we've been in bed with those guys. I believe that there has been a fundamental misapprehension of the problem on the part of the Bush administration and an ideological take on this that is divergent from reality.
Let me hear briefly from Mark Ginsburg and then back to the calls. Mark, go ahead.
The idea of the so-called even-handedness issue, to me, misses the major point about what has to happen. I mean, we all know what the solution is between Israel and the Palestinians. There needs to be two states. Any terrorist organization that is determined to sabotage a two-state solution needs to be eradicated. The Palestinians need to fight to confront that challenge. If not, the Israelis are certainly going to have to do it for them. But the Israeli government has failed to do more than enough to offer the Palestinians something of a vision as to where they may see themselves in a few years. They barely were willing to embrace the roadmap. And the Bush administration has hid behind an anything but Clinton mentality about its involvement in the Middle East. It sent General Zinni out there and let him hang rather than basically give him any power to negotiate any settlement. But as complicated as the situation is, and we're heading right now in the wrong direction, let me just say that for the United States at this point in time, we have no alternative, but to force the Sharon government to dismantle settlements and offer the Palestinians more than they were willing to offer them, because Abu Mazen, the former Palestinian prime minister who had to resign not only because Arafat sabotaged him, but because the Sharon government did very little to empower him with the Palestinians.
You're listening to The Connection from National Public Radio. Our number is 1-800-423-8255. Let's take our next call from Belvedere, New Jersey. Laura's calling in. Hi, Laura.
Good morning. This is so interesting. Howard Dean committed a truth. There seems to be something wrong in the country. I'm so glad it was just stated that Abu Mazen resigned partly because he couldn't do anything. He's a good man, apparently, but the U.S. just wouldn't lean on Israel to do anything meaningful. Release a few prisoners just before a week or two before they were going to be
Laura,
released.
What do you want to hear from the political leaders in this country that you're not hearing?
What I want to hear from the Democratic candidates, and it would take an awful lot of courage, is it doesn't seem that we're being even-handed. And what's wrong with being even-handed? It sounds like a good thing to me. It may be code speak, but
So what you're saying is that
what I'm trying to say is there's been open talk about killing Yasser Arafat, and I think that's so reprehensible. And the world needs to have the U.S. lead toward a civil society instead of assassinations, which we have done a number of in the past. In Chile.
Okay, Laura, let me just take that specifically, because Ehud Olmert is in the headlines headlines around the world, but did say yesterday that yes, indeed, the idea of killing Yasser Arafat is one of a number of options that the Israeli government has. Mark, do American politicians need to say more in response to that kind of statement? Olmert is a powerful man in Israel.
He is, and he's the same person who also came over here a few days ago and announced that the Israelis had completely complied with the roadmap by dismantling settlements. So you take Mr. Olmer and his veracity on these issues and you put him aside. But I read the internal transcripts about the cabinet decision in Israel regarding Arafat that, of course, were leaked to the major newspaper in Israel. The Israeli government is clearly frustrated, with good reason, about Arafat's continuing ability to sabotage any potential prime minister who emerges. And yet, at the same time, they were just in the middle of waging a massive war against Hamas leadership. And frankly, the more they do that, the better, as far as I'm concerned. There's nothing less than that can be done against Hamas. At the same time, resurrecting Arafat as a symbol again of Palestinian nationalism was the worst decision they could have made. It shows that there's a certain amount of frustration and bankruptcy that has crept into the Sharon government's policy towards the Palestinians. Their failure to do the things that they could do unilaterally with very little pain to themselves, such as withdrawing from the settlements that were required to be withdrawn from under the roadmap, and the administration's failure to be more emphatic about this, in my judgment, has caused the Sharon government to believe that it can get away with these issues. In fact,
so should the Democratic candidates be that emphatic voice that the administration is not?
Bill Clinton, at the very end of his administration, laid out for the first time principles that I believe were quite even-handed, and everybody embraced them as very reasonable. And yes, we owe it to the Palestinians to help them help bring a secure, safe, and peaceful state into the Middle East, and we owe it to our close allies, the Israelis, to make sure that those who want to destroy them are destroyed first. Or, in fact, neutralized.
Let me see if we can squeak in just another call here before we go to our next break. I want to go to Bedford, New Hampshire, and Barry's on the line. Barry, go ahead.
Hi. Most of my thunder has been taken away because you guys have been discussing what I was going to bring up. But just some points real quick, and I'll listen to the answer after you come back from the break. During the 2000 campaign, everybody made fun of George Bush because he didn't know how to pronounce names and he didn't know who the prime ministers were and everything else. So this argument about Dean not having the experience... I don't know. You can make the same comparison with...
Are you a Democrat?
Yeah.
And do you like that comparison?
No, I don't. And I didn't, you know, and I think we could take a picture of Bush landing on the carrier and take a picture of Michael Dukakis in the tank and put that comparison, throw it right back in the face of the Republicans and say, here's what you get. Here's what you get. Now, on to the other points about Israel. I happen to be Jewish, too. And I think that the Israeli government needs to back off a little bit. I think that they've got to understand that people do have the right to live and survive.
Barry, I need you to be specific on this, and that is, to what extent can the Democrats articulate that for you as a party member, as a supporter? What do you want to hear from them?
What Dean said was perfectly fine with me. I understand that it was interpreted as code words, but if it's in reality, there's nothing wrong with it. It is the truth. They have to back off. Poll the Israeli public. Ask them what they think about the Likud. They aren't all for it either.
Barry, thanks for your call. And okay. We will, when we come back after the break, pick up some of those points with my two guests, Joe Klein and Ambassador Mark Ginsburg. Our telephone number is 1-800-423-8255. Connection listeners, your thoughts on whether or not there are or ought to be limits on what Democratic candidates can talk about, specifically on sensitive issues of foreign policy in the run-up to the primaries. I'm Dick Gordon. This is The Connection from NPR. To The Connection from National Public Radio. I'm Dick Gordon. With me on the program, Ambassador Mark Ginsburg and Joe Klein, senior writer for Time magazine, and a conversation about what the Democrats are or ought to be speaking about on, specifically on foreign policy at this point in the campaign. And Joe Klein, if I can pick up one aspect of what Barry was talking about, it got me thinking of something that you've said earlier, and that is that Dean's at a very, very interesting moment in his own particular campaign now, in that a lot of people saw the rocket ship go up in the summertime and thought, yeah, that won't last long. You know, it'll come crashing back to Earth. But now there are more people paying attention to what he says. So does that mean this is the moment for him to be unconventional, bold, you know, do the sort of thing that he says he's been doing? Or is this the time for him to go back and, you know, take a more careful look at what he's saying, because he may be accountable for that?
Well, I think it's time for him to be responsibly bold. You know, his candor is what got him here, and the fact that he doesn't speak the way the other politicians do is what created this success. But I think one of the basic rules of politics is that if your opposition just absolutely loves something that you've said, you've probably said the wrong thing. And I can guarantee you that the Bush people, the White House, Karl Rove, were just thrilled when Dean made those comments about Israel for a very specific political reason, and that is the Jewish community in Florida. May not be the right thing in terms of American policy in the long run, but in terms of American politics in the short run, I think Dean hurt himself significantly there.
Can I just get you to clarify something for me? You've referred a couple of times to the Jewish voters in Florida. In what way would that group of people be different from Jewish voters in New York or Boston, for example?
Well, you remember Florida.
I do remember Florida. But
I mean, what we're talking about...
You're saying that's a more swing vote there?
We're talking about a state that went 50-50 in the last election. And this is essentially, you know, given the difficulties that Bush is running into now in foreign policy, this is still a pretty much a 50-50 country. That's going to be a determining state. And I'm sure that the calculation is being made. If we can peel away 5%, 7%, 8% of the Jewish vote in Florida, we can win that state, the Republicans are thinking. And so, you know, Jews in Florida are more significant than Jews in Nebraska, because the Jewish vote in Nebraska isn't going to tip the election one way or the other.
Okay, 1-800.
Or Jews in New York, for that matter. You know, every Jew in New York could switch from Democrat to Republican, and the state will still be
Democrat.
A Democratic state.
All right, 1-800-423-8255. To Lexington, Massachusetts, Bob's joining us now. Hi, Bob.
Hi.
Thanks for calling. Go ahead.
Okay. I think that the discussion here today is focusing on the wrong issues for the Democratic Party.
Okay.
And there are a number of issues which I think that the average citizen is concerned about. And that is, number one, the loss of say and control over their own life due to national policies. Number two is a safety issue. Number three is
what does this have to do
issue.
with foreign policy, Bob? Are you saying that foreign policy is a non-starter of an issue?
I'm saying that foreign policy is a non-starter issue. I'm also saying that after 20 years of dealing in international relations issues, that the two panel members, I disagree entirely with their stance on the Middle East. You know, it's just based on 20 years of knowledge and discussions and dealing with those issues. And I think that it's way down on the bottom of the list of what's really going to win the vote. I think that the other issues are going to decide the vote. It's say
the other issues
your
own being
life,
the economy, it's homeland
economy,
security, that sort
safety
of thing.
Issue, income issue, shifting taxes away from ability pay. Shifting it to the middle class.
Okay, Bob. Let me take the thrust of your point and ask first Mark and then Joe to talk about just what the place of foreign policy is going to be as we move through this year.
Well, the bread and butter issues are always the issues that appeal most to Democrats, and certainly the caller is right to point out that the issues of the economy, the incredibly stupidity of the tax cuts, and the ballooning deficit, the $87 billion that we now need for Iraq, which is still just a drop in the bucket of what the Bush administration will have to come clean on, and so far as the future is concerned. Sure, these are all issues, but when you really look at the polling data, that I look at insofar as what voters really believe in. There's a huge spread in the issue of trust between Democrats and Republicans when it comes to national security issues. There's almost a 35% difference between voters who say, on the one hand, that they are voting Republican because they trust Republicans to make them more secure, and Democrats. Democrats will not win a national election until that gap is closed. And while it's always good for us to focus on these issues, we are at war. And the Democrats have been painted into a corner by the Karl Rove spin machine, that we do not have the determination and the capability to wage an intelligent war against terrorism, and that the Bush people are the only ones who do it. And frankly, I don't think they've been very intelligent. I agree with Joe on that. So I don't agree with the caller. We are going to have to demonstrate that national security is now personal security. Whether the caller likes it or not, what happens to in our homeland is as much governed by the events abroad as any time in our history.
Joe.
Yeah. You know, the caller's right historically that it's been economic and domestic policy issues that have... that decide elections. Foreign policy is usually way, way, way down the list. But there is now a very major foreign policy question that is at the heart of not only, security issues, but also economic issues. And that is, have the decisions that George Bush has made particularly in Iraq, made us safer? And what's it doing to our economy? I mean, you know, when he called for $87 billion, which I believe he should get and which we absolutely need, it was a number that had some resonance for me, because most experts believe that you could get universal health insurance in this country for between $80 and $90 billion a year. So the president's priority in this case, the way he's gone about it, the fact that we have the United States Army, the greatest fighting force in the history of the world, pinned down in the desert and being degraded on a daily basis. You know, the military people I talk to are horrified by the probability that we're going to have to spend another summer in Baghdad. So these are all major issues that not only affect foreign policy, but they also affect fiscal policy, and they may well affect the economy.
Okay, but Mark, you parsed this in your article, saying that it's very important that anyone who hopes to draw attention to what they say are the problems of the current administration not go back and have the old debate about whether or not it was the right thing to go into Iraq, but to move specifically into the area that Joe's describing about, so what's the right thing to do now?
Precisely. The battle over whether or not we should have been in Iraq in the first place is now left to those who sit around drinking tea and cappuccino. The issue now is, how do we defend our troops? How do we best protect our national security? How do we avoid a defeat in the desert that would result in the total, utter destruction of American foreign policy in the Middle East?
But isn't there a danger that Dean is stuck in the former part of that debate, still debating that?
Go ahead, Mark.
I disagree.
I think Dean has tried to have it both ways. He's been extraordinarily critical of the war. And he's also said at the same time that we have to stay and persevere. But yet, I've said in my article that both he and the other Democrats, including Kerry, have failed to lay out that vision. It's not adequate enough for the neocons to merely say we want to democratize the Middle East and we invaded Iraq because it was a hotbed of terrorism. What really is at stake here is far more fundamental, and that is our entire personal security at home is dependent to an extent to which we are able to deal both economically, politically, and militarily with the problems of Islamic radicalism. The administration's decision to go into Iraq was for the wrong reasons that it articulated. We were never going to find weapons of mass destruction, in my estimation. We were never going to find a direct link to Al-Qaeda and 9/11. What we were going to find is yet another regime that was going to be able to serve as a catalyst in the long run to helping to exploit the increasing antipathy against the United States by those Muslims who see their perverse problems in the Middle East as caused by American policies.
You're listening to The Connection from National Public Radio. Joe, you wanted in on this as well.
Yes, I did. I think you have to have both conversations. Obviously, the issues on the ground right now are paramount, and we have to make sure. As a journalist, I have to make sure that I call these candidates when they say irresponsible things, like Howard Dean's notion that you could replace 80,000 American troops with UN troops. You know, the reality is that we may get 15,000 at most from the UN. But on the other hand, we have to have a conversation about this president's fundamental sense of America's place in the world and foreign policy judgments. In my opinion, he made a phenomenal misjudgment in the way he went about going into Iraq and going into Iraq, period. I mean, right now we have a crisis that is of this president's making. And I think that we have to have a conversation about that. The fact that the United States is less respected in almost every country in the world. And by the way, the polling data from overseas is a lot more accurate than it is here, because they go door to door. The polling data in Bangladesh is more accurate than it is in New Hampshire. I think that we have a serious point here, is that we have a real crisis when the Secretary of State of the United States cannot go back to the UN with 8x10 photographs of anything and have people believe that he's telling the truth after what's happened in Iraq.
I want to try and get another caller in here. So let's go to Youngsville, North Carolina. David's on the line. David, go ahead.
Hey there.
Hi.
Thanks for taking my call.
Yeah.
I guess my main point is that the Democrats, I don't think, are going to win if they keep trying to kowtow to, I'll call them Republican values. Like when we had this Senate election here last year, Erskine Bowles was, like, boring. He picked, like, safe issues, stuff that was just, and there was all these other issues that could have came out. And Howard Dean at least seems to be talking in ways, doesn't seem to be running from his shadow. He doesn't have, like people on your panel here giving him advice, and he's going to, like, say, oh, well, I'm going to, like, make sure that I'm not going to upset all the Republicans or the independent or leaning Republican. He doesn't seem to be that afraid of that thing.
And you admire that.
I admire that. And I'm a Southern white, you could say redneck or whatever.
I'm going to call you a redneck, maybe a NASCAR dad or something.
Not if you're listening to NPR.
I'm exaggerating that a little bit, but I admire that. I wasn't for the war. I'm still
David, I'm going to let you go. I've only got about a minute left in the program, and I would like just a real quick response from both Joe Klein and Mark on this. Can you guys keep it to about 30 seconds apiece? Mark first.
I think Howard Dean has shown an enormous courage, and I'm not concerned so much about his early missteps. I've met with him. He came to our foreign policy organization. He did a great job. At the same time, he needs to have a much clearer vision of where he's taking this country in this war on terror. And until he gets that foundation laid, he's prone to missteps, and so he's going to have to spend a little more time thinking these issues through, because the American people need that, not just liberal Democrats.
All right, Joe Klein.
There's a difference between boldness and carelessness. Howard Dean has been both, and as this process goes on, he's going to have to be a lot more careful about the things that he says. It's a difficult job to be bold and careful, but that's what he's got to do.
Joe, thanks so much for being with us. Joe Klein, senior writer for Time Magazine. Mark Ginsburg, nice to have you on the program.
Thank you.
Mark was ambassador to Morocco during the Clinton administration. He's the author of How the Democrats Can Compete on Foreign Policy. It's in the latest edition of the Weekly Standard. Connection listeners, you're welcome to continue this conversation in the forum section of our website. We are at theconnection.org. Our program's produced by Khalil Bird, Sarah Field, Kelly Jones, Orit Karitsky-Fox, Jen Mattson, Lindsay Miller, Christina Russo, and Doug Sugarts. Our senior producer is Tara Murphy. I'm Dick Gordon. This is The Connection. We'll be right back.